What if the polarization we see in U.S. American politics right now is a necessary step towards a cultural evolution? What if the current process of differentiating political perspectives can help us clarify the components of the world we are building towards?
Polarity is a characteristic of the becoming of the new. Things are unfolding, right? They're evolving. Sometimes they regress. As new things emerge, they push off against the old to create something new, and that creates a polarity, right? Polarity is just a pattern of development or unfolding or growth.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Fractal Friends. My name is Duncan Autry, and today's guest is Steve McIntosh. In the spirit of the Fractal Friends project, where we are exploring our self-similarity across our diversity, this episode is about attempting to shift the conversation in our society from a polarized left versus right political debate to a conversation where we start to consider how we all might fit together. I want to invite you to imagine for a moment a political culture that we can all get behind. Imagine living in a country where we choose to take care of and look out for all of our fellow countrymen, the sick, the poor, the needy, the oppressed, the disenfranchised. Imagine committing to supporting the folk that are simply struggling to make ends meet, and to those who are striving to reach their true potential. Imagine that we can create a space for all of them. Imagine that in this government we are fiscally responsible, and that we work hard to maintain a small and efficient government that will not become bloated, rack up national debt, or overwhelm us with bureaucracy. Imagine that this society honors the best of the values and traditions that got us to where we are, while also honestly acknowledging the dark periods of our history. Imagine a culture rooted in the deep ideas of democracy and freedom. Imagine celebrating the Constitution, the heritage, and the wisdom that got the United States into being a world leader in the first place. And also imagine making amends and reparations for the history of slavery and colonialization that is also part of getting the United States to the place that it is today. Imagine the country acting from that place of integrity and wisdom and stepping forward as a true leader of positive global progress. Imagine a country that is able to protect the environment and that cherishes cultural, religious, and secular diversity. Imagine becoming a model for the kind of world that we want to live in, and being confident enough to allow space for a diverse, international, human society. Imagine a culture where we can hold on to and bring with us the best things that got us to where we are, while moving forward to a better future. Is that kind of government or political culture possible? I don't know. What I do know, however, is that that's the kind of world that I want to live in, and that's the kind of world that I want to work towards. In this conversation with Steve McIntosh, we get a glimpse of what that world might look like and how we might get there. And he helps us see how we might face, understand, and overcome the challenges that we will face in that journey. And if that wasn't enough, this conversation also opens into some of my other favorite topics. We talk about the creation of spaces that are both secular and spiritual. And we talk about fractals. And we talk about interdependent polarities. I am super psyched about all the things that we talk about in this conversation. And for those who are interested in these topics, I want to encourage you to come to the fractalfriends.us website, because I'll be sharing a lot of materials from Steve McIntosh there. There are essays and videos and links that are all relevant to what you're about to hear in this conversation. I also just want to frame something. This topic about trying to integrate politics is, well, inherently a controversial topic. We're also talking about integrating religion and science, and that's also controversial. We discuss all of this in the frame of integral theory, which also not everyone in the world agrees with. I just want to acknowledge that this conversation should prompt some really interesting thoughts. And if you have those and you want to share them, I would love for you to come over to Fractal Friends website, fractalfriends.us, and make some comments on the blog there. This would be a great place to have this conversation and have it go forward. And I want to thank you in advance for your participation in the conversation and for your respectful sharing of your ideas. I look forward to the conversation. And finally, before we get started, I want to acknowledge that this episode is particularly U.S. American centric. That's not something that I want to do in general on this podcast. And I suppose that that's understandable given the political season of the United States right now. I simply just want to acknowledge that polarization is a universal theme, and that all around the world, we are being invited to face questions about how we create inclusive societies. Thank you for your patience with the U.S. focus today, and thank you for listening to Fractal Friends. I now give you my conversation with Steve McIntosh.
Steve, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Pleasure to be with you, Duncan.
And I'm really, really excited to talk to you, to meet you, and to create a space to share your perspective and your thoughts with the world. And I think you have a lot of really important things to say, especially at this time in the course of humanity, in the course of American politics. So I'm just really excited to share that. I was wondering if you just want to give a little bit of a sense of explaining who you are before we get into the conversation.
Sure. Well, I'm a writer and a participant in an emerging intellectual community, which we anticipate will become a larger social movement. It's been bubbling up for a long time. It's got a variety of labels at this point, none of which are fully satisfactory. Probably the leading label for this intellectual community or this emerging perspective is integral philosophy, integral theory. But other names include an evolutionary perspective, a developmental view, a postmodern perspective, metamodern. I mean, there's lots of different ways we could describe this, but we're talking about a movement and culture which, to those of us who were involved in it, seems like the beginning of something momentous emerging in history. Even when we try to be as modest and humble as we can about the situation, it feels like what's emerging with this integral perspective is a kind of a second enlightenment, with reference to the enlightenment that occurred in Europe and America in the 16th and the 17th and 18th centuries, which brought about a new worldview, which within integral parlance is known as modernism, or in the larger culture, it's often referred to as modernity, that sort of scientific perspective that emphasizes progress and meritocracy and democracy and many of the good things which came out of the Enlightenment, maturing into the Industrial Revolution and bringing about our increasingly globalized world, compared to the sort of the oppressive, feudalistic, religious-based societies that existed before the modern, modernity has brought many important things in the world. As I argue, it's created more cultural evolution than any worldview before or since. But it's also brought horrific problems, new problems, that the previous traditional stage of cultural development didn't have, namely environmental degradation on a global scale, nuclear proliferation, gross inequality. So there's lots of things about modernity which cause us to want better, to do further. And for the last 50 years, just by way of quick background, another significant worldview has emerged in America and elsewhere, primarily in the developed world, which began to be recognized as a discrete, distinct worldview that could be compared to this modernist worldview and the traditional worldview that preceded it. And within integral parlance, this worldview is known as postmodernism, sometimes called the green worldview or progressive pluralism, the cultural creatives. It has a lot of labels. And I've been, ever since I was a teenager, I've sort of been identified with and participating in this countercultural worldview, both in terms of the alternative spirituality that this worldview has brought, and many of the alternative political perspectives as well. But just to kind of frame this story, beginning in the late 1990s, I've always had a sense in my life, really since the 70s, that there would be a kind of a renaissance or what we hoped would be a spiritual renaissance that would occur. And it seemed like in the 90s with the fluorescence of progressive spirituality that it was kind of a spiritual renaissance. But by the end of the 90s, by the turn of the millennium, many of us who were participating in this progressive spiritual movement, this kind of postmodern alternative culture, became dissatisfied with it. In other words, it was so countercultural, so antithetical, so to the larger society, so sort of anti-establishment, for good reasons, but also in reasons that made it impotent in a way that it could break away from the larger society, but it's the gravity of its values wasn't necessarily strong enough to continue to bring the rest of the society to be a beacon of the future that could pull people into a more inclusive and more holistic perspective. And it was around that time, 1999, 2000, that I was drawn into this emerging integral movement, which is in a sense attempts to transcend the postmodern, the green. It tries to go beyond that from a kind of the antithesis to the mainstream culture to a synthesis that tries to re-include the best of what's come before. So that is the frame of thinking, this view of cultural evolution that recognizes that humanity over the last 400 years has emerged beyond the traditional religious civilizations into this sort of modernity that's globalizing. And then there's been another major development, which has sort of tried to push off against the shortcomings of modernity. And so now in America, we have three major worldviews that vie for the allegiance of the culture as a whole. You know, traditionalism, which is about 30%, modernity, which is the majority of about 50% of Americans, frame reality with this modernist worldview. And then about 20% of this emerging worldview, the postmodern worldview, traditional modern and postmodern are the labels for these three. This integral perspective tries to take the best of the values of every one, all three of these worldviews, and bring them together into a more inclusive and synthetic worldview that can appreciate the best of all of those while also seeing clearly the shortcomings and the pathologies of each one of those worldviews. And so the politics that I'm focused on is coming from this perspective, viewing our current political situation from this developmental understanding that can see things moving and recognize the larger culture war, as it's sometimes called, as really the outworking of an evolving cultural ecosystem. So, you know, that's a mouthful, but that's maybe a good place to start in terms of where I'm coming from politically as a perspective.
Just thank you so much for laying that out. It's a lot of information, but it's also, I think that was very clear, so I appreciate that. So we have these three sort of worldviews playing out in our current society. And, you know, one of the main ideas of the Fractal Friends project is to help us start shifting the conversation. How do we move past the question of us versus them, or move past these questions of right versus wrong, and start trying to ask, okay, we're all here together. How is that going to work? How can we all sort of coexist? And one of my ways that I've been thinking about it is this theory that I've been tinkering with for the last couple of years, which I've been calling like the fractal yin-yang theory. And the idea being that, you know, there are this, in a sense, these duality of these sides. Sometimes you can think of them as like agency and communion, but basically, you know, on one hand, there's this part of us that wants to sort of go forward and protect ourselves and just make sure that our identity is preserved and taken care of. And then there's also this need to sort of be in community with others, and where we want to sort of reach out, and we're trying to find this balance between the two. And what I always like to sort of point out is that this is it's not a choice. We're not actually making a choice. Do we go forward or do we stay where we are? We have to do both. And it's actually the interaction between the two that is what makes life basically what it is. And so I'm really excited that in some of your most recent papers, and I think a lot of your work, in fact, you talk about the idea of polarity theory and the idea of the interdependence of the polarities. And how these polarities are basically need each other to go forward, and that they can't be separated from each other. And so the question isn't who's going to win, but how do we fit it all together into one package? So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about polarity theory and that aspect and how that fits into this integration of all these different voices.
Sure. So let me come about it by beginning with a little story.
Sure.
of how I sort of came to see the power of this polarity thinking when it's applied to America's political challenges here in 2016.
Yeah, great example. Yeah.
So I've been involved as a writer of books and an activist in this integral community, as we've discussed. And one of the real clear perspectives that this way of seeing brings is an understanding of culture. You can see culture more clearly through a developmental lens, when you can see how these values are moving, when you see these larger patterns of evolution, when you understand how cultural evolution isn't the same thing as biological evolution. It's kind of a new domain with its own, you know, laws and behaviors. But there's still this structure of emergence where something more keeps coming from something less. And so I make arguments for progress in culture and progress in history and progress in even biology in my 2012 book, Evolution's Purpose. But this perspective on culture has political implications because so many of our political problems have cultural foundations to the problems. So a group of colleagues and I who were very interested in this integral application to politics could see that, at least in 2012 and 2013, that that climate change was a major political issue that had a deep cultural dimension in terms of people's resistance to it and their being those who were drawn to it and those who were repulsed by it as an issue, and that we felt a duty to try to weigh in on the climate change debate by bringing an integral interpretation of the cultural underpinnings of the problem. I mean, at least the problem of building political will to combat climate change. So we founded this think tank. We focused on climate change. We had a campaign plan for influencing culture there, and we made some reasonable headway. But after working on climate change for about 18 months, I began to see that the underlying issue, at least the one where we could have an impact from a cultural political perspective, was the issue of polarization, right? Hyper-partisan polarization. It's one of American politics' most difficult problems. I mean, we've become, in a sense, with our system of checks and balances, which is written into the Constitution, when we have relatively equal size of the left and the right, America's become a kind of a vetocracy, you know, where one side has a veto on the positive programs of the other. So this, and even if Hillary Clinton wins this coming election with a relatively strong mandate, a large majority, as it looks like she will, there'll still be the obstructionist opposition on the other side, which will continue to block her positive programs in the ways they blocked Obama's programs. And if, you know, heaven forfend, Donald Trump becomes elected, there'll be, you know, an obstructionist opposition opportunity on the other side. So we have this hope that these elections are going to matter, and they obviously do matter, but because of this intense gridlock, not just in the Congress, but in the federal government as a whole, our politics are effectively broken and dysfunctional. And this underlying problem of hyperpartisan polarization is one of the main barriers to effective cooperation on some reasonable steps toward ameliorating climate change. So, for the past since early 2014, the primary focus of the think tank has been the problem of polarization. And as we've worked on the problem of polarization, obviously a very relevant theoretical understanding, which isn't being discussed or understood within the mainstream discourse of politics, is the application of polarity theory to this stuck polarity that we have in politics. And polarity theory, it dovetails perfectly with a larger body of integral philosophy, because in some ways it sheds a light on the operation of this larger evolutionary pattern of dialectical development, right? You know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That's a pattern of evolution that you can see in cosmological evolution, biological evolution, and increasingly within cultural evolution. These stages that we've talked about are in this dialectical relationship of thesis and antithesis and, you know, synthesis. And that's a whole discussion unto itself. But as a quick framing of polarity theory, let me say that there are the world is full of polarities, right? They're ubiquitous. But there are many kinds of polarities, but the two main categories that are important to understand for the application of polarity theory to politics is that there are positive-negative polarities and positive-positive polarities, right? So positive-negative polarities like good and bad, or, you know, prosperity and poverty, they present problems to be solved, right? So I think that as our culture evolves and we become more wealthy and connected, that poverty, global poverty, is really a problem that we can solve. And I think one day, perhaps, certainly not in my lifetime, but you know, with luck, with grace, the world will evolve to the point where very few or maybe no one is impoverished. So that's an example of a positive-negative polarity. Positive-positive polarities are not problems to be solved. They're systems to be managed because they're indestructible. They continue to reappear. And part of what makes these positive-positive polarities interesting is that both values and things that create value naturally seem to cohere in polar sets, whereby any value-creating approach or activity often finds that its value is somewhat contingent upon a kind of an equal and opposite form of value creation. So a classic example would be competition and cooperation. Right? Within progressive culture, cooperation is often championed over competition, right? You know, competition bad, cooperation good. But from a polarity management perspective or polarity understanding, competition and cooperation are indestructible, because if you are focused exclusively on cooperation to the exclusion of competition, then the value-generating potentials of cooperation become diminished, right? In other words, if you're just cooperating and there's no chance for individual initiative or excellence or creativity, then attempts to be cooperative can lead to total value relativism or bureaucratic stagnation. And in the same way, if you just focused on competition without any cooperative frame, then it would become dog-eat-dog, people would become paranoid, and the value-creating potentials of the competitive engagement would be diminished and eventually result in pathology. So where you find a positive-positive polarity, you know, I can mention some others, right? So mercy and justice, or freedom and order, or even male and female. When you have a positive-positive polarity, it's procreative in the sense that the two together can create something more, right? So if competition helps to keep cooperation from becoming stagnant, and cooperation keeps competition focused on a positive goal, then in this positive-positive relationship, these two value-creating ends are like two legs of progress, right? So you know, I could go on and lay out some more theory of polarities, but let me say that this is particularly relevant when we recognize that ideally this positive-positive polarity exists in politics between the right and the left. Now, I'm talking about the healthy version of the left and the healthy mm-hmm. version of the right, sort of what they could be in their value-creating potentials. Right. Many on the left see those on the right as a positive-negative polarity. In other words, that the right is wrong and the left is right, and if the left could just effectively vanquish the right, then we'd be on our way to a more compassionate and greater socially just society. But while there are certainly many circumstances where you have a polarity in politics where one side is wrong or in bad faith, because the polarity of left and right continues to reappear at every scale and almost every political context, it gives us a clue that this is a sort of an indestructible polarity, and therefore we're presented with a system to be managed rather than an enemy to be vanquished. Now, I vote consistently for Democrats, right? I'm on the left, so to speak. But through my understanding of the evolution of culture and through the application of this polarity thinking to politics, I can see how there are elements, there are values that are typically associated with the right, which our civilization is going to need going forward. But because those values are often completely tied in with pathologies, when people on the left look at people on the right, mostly what they see are these pathologies. Now, in this election year, it's particularly difficult to talk about this because we have Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, and I'm not willing to be his apologist or to say that somehow, you know, Donald Trump has this sort of good side that we need to embrace. That's not what I'm talking about at all. But what I am talking about is values on the right, like liberty and heritage, that are not necessarily owned by the right. I mean, there are people on the left who value liberty and heritage, but the source of these values is found in worldviews that are typically aligned with libertarian and conservative perspectives. And if we want to, if we want the right to evolve, if we want the right to be able to purge characters like Donald Trump and be more responsible, then hating on them or making them wrong or you know, taking the stance of a positive negative polarity that's just an enemy to be vanquished, I think that's just going to create more gridlock and it's going to stymie the laudable positive projects that many people on the left would like to see move forward, like climate change and immigration reform and dealing with the inequality that plagues our system. You know, it because we live in a democracy, we need to persuade the people of good sense and the good faith on the right, and there are many, that there is a way forward, and we can overcome polarization, and we can rescue our democracy from, you know, political decay. And one of the ways we can do that is begin to not so much engage with people's interests, but engage with people's values. You know, it's a sort of a new political practice that's emerging. In other words, just let me give an example, and then I'll let you jump in.
Sure. Yeah.
Gay marriage is an issue which is, despite the fact that almost every issue is, every other political issue is stuck, gay marriage has moved forward tremendously as an issue, gained huge ground both politically and socially, you know, over the last 5 years. And one of the reasons that gay marriage has been so successful is that that issue effectively incorporates values from across the spectrum. Not only does it does it forward postmodern, you know, or green liberation values, right? Because we, you know, we gay rights are one of the accomplishments of this sort of postmodern politics. You know, very important accomplishment. There's also sort of modernist Democrat fairness values. There's also libertarian freedom values. And crucially, there's also traditional conservative family values. So even though traditionalists or, you know, social conservatives may not see their interests represented in the forwarding of gay marriage, their values are carried along nonetheless, because making a family commitment to another person is a deeply traditional value. And the fact that it's been extended to gay people in a way forwards the interests of conservatives in spite of their objections. And this technique of recognizing that there's values that are in a sense resident or the accomplishments of, kind of owned by these folks who identify with the right, that we can carry forward their values, and if we do that, then this us versus them mentality can be diminished. It's sort of an integral approach to overcoming polarization.
Oh, Steve, I just absolutely love that example. I just love this whole thing you're laying out, because I think it's so important for people to hear. And, you know, because it feels so hard, the polarization right now is so hard. And one of the things I'm terrified right now about is how this is in the next month, this is going to play out as people are going to get more and more polarized. I'm really, you know, watching people get entrenched behind Donald Trump behind Hillary Clinton, and watching the Bernie Sanders supporters struggle with what they're going to do as they've tried to support Clinton or not. And it's going to be a tense time. I think it's really a great time for us to be recognizing that we're all in this together here. And sort of one of the integration points that seems like really important around this politics, this sort of conservative progressive tension, is that the question is, how do we grow and improve as a society and hold on to the rich traditions that got us here in the first place? You know, and how can we do that? And in order to answer that question, we're going to need to talk across this whole spectrum. And so I know that you talk also about this idea of, like, how can the left and the right evolve? And maybe it's worth taking these separately because their stories are a little different. But, you know, both of them are in a place of tension right now, where there's sort of this mainstream center and this very significant group that's saying, we don't want to do things the way we've been doing it anymore. And so there's this tension within both the left and the right. And that tension sort of speaks to a potential for integration within each of the parties. And in a way, what they're going to need to do is each side, and not necessarily parties, but political spectrums, but the parties is how we have it set up in our country. But on both sides, there's going to have to be a conversation about how do we integrate the voices within the left and the right. And there's an evolution there. And part of the question that they have to answer is, what would it look like to bring our best face forward? What would it be like to step forward and to actually court the other side and say, hey, look, this is what I care about. And I know that there's part of me that's challenging and everyone has a shadow, but how can we bring our best sides forward? So I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about this idea of the left evolving and the right evolving, and what are some of the challenges that you see them facing in particular in that process?
Sure. Well, again, the best way to kind of really unpack that question is with reference to these stages of development that we talked about at the beginning, right? Traditional, modern, and postmodern.
Right.
And for most traditionalists, because they're socially conservative, they're almost all voting on the right, right? I mean, there are some people who are traditionalists or evangelicals who vote on the left, but the vast majority are on the right. Within modernity, we have the classical division between liberals and conservatives, and so modernity split, you know, probably 55 liberal, 45, you know, fiscally conservative. Then within the postmodern worldview, it's almost all left, right? I mean, there are some libertarian postmodernists, but for the most part, people who are green are stridently left, right? You know, kind of many of them are radical leftists.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, that's understandable. It's maybe evolutionarily appropriate that when postmodernism emerged as a cultural force in the 60s and the 70s, what the evolutionary opportunity that it had was to push off against modernity, to be countercultural and to reject the values of modernity, which were seen as focused on status and material and intense and stifling scientific rationality. I mean, it's sort of the breaking free of the grip of the modernist establishment led to a new kind of left-wing politics, right? A kind of countercultural politics, even though sort of Marxism and progressivism had been part of the American political scene. It played a minor role, you know, throughout the 20th century. Beginning in the 70s, a whole new kind of left emerged, the new left, as it was originally called, and they were able to make headway, you know, and they'd made progress in terms of, like I said, you know, gay rights and the focus on the environment, Earth Day, the furtherance of the elimination of sexism and racism. There have been many important accomplishments that this kind of postmodern or countercultural left, while not entirely responsible for, you know, I would say is largely responsible for. So that's an important move in history. But just like modernity is not the end of history, you know, postmodernism has tried to find values that go beyond that and try to remedy the shortcomings of modernity. Postmodernism itself is not the end of history too, right? So where do we go from here? What are the evolutionary opportunities for moving beyond, for growing out of polarization and our political dysfunction? I mean, I think it's a cultural problem primarily, although reducing gerrymandering or opening primaries or having greater civil discourse, polarization is a wicked problem, right? And like most wicked problems, it has many causes and no obvious solution. So I applaud and commend all those structural and procedural attempts to overcome polarities and polarization. But ultimately, we see it as primarily a cultural problem and the real solution. I mean, those other solutions like getting rid of gerrymandering, that presupposes the kind of cooperative political will that's missing in the first place. So starting at culture and saying, you know, how can we grow? Where is an opportunity to grow? Part of it involves growing beyond the postmodern rejection of, you know, modernism and traditionalism, a kind of a reclaiming of the strengths of modernity and traditionalism, but at the same time also acknowledging and standing on the shoulders of the postmodern accomplishments, right? So we want to move from the antithesis of the postmodern to the synthesis of the integral. And the way that happens is, we recognize that just like in modernity, there are people who are on the right and people who are on the left. At the integral stage, it becomes, you know, socially and culturally and you know, ideationally acceptable for people to have an integral perspective and identify as having more affinity for the right. Whereas there are very few people who can have affinity for the right who are in postmodernism. At the integral, it becomes balanced again, you know, like a sort of a higher harmonic of modernism. So you see plenty of people who are thoroughly integral in their level of development, but who still vote for Republicans or who consider themselves libertarians. So recognizing that, the focus of the think tank, those who we're communicating with mostly are modernists. We're communicating with the mainstream, you know, the blogosphere and the pundits and the philanthropists who are supporting us are almost all modernists. So that's our audience. But since I've had the opportunity to talk about this emerging integral perspective, from our perspective, the future of the right and the future of the left are the integral expressions of both of those sides, right? So an integral left is different from a postmodern left, and an integral right is certainly different from a modernist right. Even though from some perspectives they may have similarities, when you understand where this integral perspective is coming from, you can see some discrete differences. So what would make an integral left and an integral right different from the kind of political discourse and platforms and positions that we see now is that an integral version of the left and right would incorporate more of the other side, you know, but without necessarily meeting in the middle. You know, it's not centrism; it's sort of a growth. And so the analogy I can use is the way that our society's ideals of masculinity and femininity have evolved since the 50s. Like in the 50s, masculine and feminine in American society were highly polarized, right? So our ideals of a real man were John Wayne, you know, sort of macho tough guy, right? And our ideals of femininity were demure, sort of June Cleaver types, right? And although there were plenty of examples, you know, all over the map, few will deny that our conception of what an ideal woman and an ideal man or masculine and feminine, how those mores and expectations have evolved. Part of the way they've evolved is now what it means to be a real woman includes being strong and independent, you know, strengths that were once considered, you know, purely masculine, but now they're not just masculine, they're strengths that every human can have, man or woman. Likewise, being a real man now includes being sensitive and emotional and incorporating and being able to express characteristics that were once thought to be strictly reserved for the feminine side. Yet, and we've also come to accept a whole range of gender identities, and that's evolution too. And regardless of one's biology, seeing this, that one side's evolving by being able to incorporate the strengths of the other, that's an analogy for how the left can evolve. The left can evolve by recognizing that there are values which, because they're usually associated with the right, are often repudiated or many on the left are blind to the important values, for example, of liberty, the important values of keeping the government, you know, from getting too big, the idea that that there is a fragile ecology not only of nature, but also of our globalizing modernist economy, you know, and that postmodern culture depends on the wealth and the freedom and the connectivity that modernity has achieved. And so if we're going to be a more mature version of the left, then we're going to be less stridently anti-modernist and recognize that modernity is in a sense a kind of evolutionary development that we that deserves our protection and there's a sort of way in which a greater regard for the gifts of prosperity and the gifts of progress that modernity has brought to us, that we want to transcend the limitations of that, but we need to carefully include the strengths of that. I could say a lot more, but that's probably a good place to let you jump in.
Well, sure. Well, I think, and this speaks a little bit to the fractal nature of it, that if we think about the left and the right, if we look at the right as like tradition and we think about the left as sort of being progressive and trying to move things forward. But if you look within the right, you also have those dynamics. You have the group that's trying to really hold back on the social values, but and another part that's really trying to move forward economically. And so you have that same left-right split within the right. And within the left, you have the same sort of left-right split. And we can imagine that that's happening not just on those political parties, but within our conversations, within our families. It gets all the way down to inside of ourselves. We have our parts of ourselves that want to just keep things the way they are, and we also sort of want to move forward. And so that fractal nature is sort of happening across the spectrum. I know that you sort of frame it in different ways.
That's really interesting. I would agree with that for sure.
Yeah.
I would say that polarity is a characteristic of the becoming of the new, right? In other words, we live in this universe of becoming, right? Things are unfolding, right? They're evolving. Sometimes they regress. But what Terence McKenna called the ingression of novelty, right, is a fact of our existence. You know, new things keep emerging. And as new things emerge, they push off against the old to create something new, and that creates a polarity, right? Polarity is just a pattern of development or unfolding or growth. And understanding that the natural tension can be kind of understood schematically as part and whole. You know, the part emerges from the whole, it creates a polarity, it matures to the point where then the part then gives birth, you know, to another part, and then the cycle continues. And the reason that our world or our evolving culture is characterized by these polarities is it is a kind of a fractal expression of the larger whole. And this is sort of the cosmic dimensions of understanding why polarities are ubiquitous and why we inevitably find ourselves using these structures and these systems as vehicles for our own growth and our own understanding. And that's because the entire universe can be understood as a kind of a part and whole, that being and becoming, or infinite and finite, or, you know, sort of the emergence of the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, that in a sense is the primordial polarity. And this primordial polarity can be seen refracted self-similarly, or fractally, as you put it, throughout the cosmos. So in other words, every time the ubiquitous polarities that we find ourselves engaged in, you know, both in politics and in our family and everywhere we turn, when we see those as, in a sense, portals for growth or engines of evolution or events of emergence, right? There's all kinds of philosophical ways of getting at what this is. But when we understand that that's a tiny little, you know, micro expression of the macro pattern, then this gives us a kind of a philosophical technology with which we can work with these polarities in a way that facilitates both our own self-actualization and, the making of the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I want to ask kind of a very specific question here. So I'm part of this group that's been forming here in Oakland called Thrive East Bay. And they have been creating a space where it's bringing together a diversity of people across race and class and age, but also across these spectrums. I would say there's a large group of modernists and postmodernists and people with evolutionary sort of integral perspective also. And the community, it has kind of a spiritual feel to it, but it's explicitly not a spiritual space. It's not a religious space. It's focused on the idea of trying to make a better world. And there's this interesting tension of the sort of need to create space for a secular kind of spirituality. But then there's also this people trying to integrate their own experiences with religion. And then there's people who have this sort of their own spirituality, which would sort of be this kind of modern, postmodern, I guess, non-religious spirituality. And all of these pieces are sort of dancing together and all these different voices. And everyone's kind of triggered by each other's feelings, right? Like, oh, I don't know if I like you mentioning God, and I don't know if I want you to call the infinite, and what do you mean by evolution? And in those kinds of spaces, what kind of, I don't know, advice would you have or feedback for giving people a chance to sort of communicate with each other in those places where they're actually interacting and trying to work together, but also living in that diversity?
Yeah. Well, we are trying to evolve our consciousness. I mean, in other words, integral philosophy could be boiled down to two words. That is, consciousness evolves. And consciousness evolves by discrete steps, and the consciousness doesn't evolve by itself, it evolves with culture. So we can see these stages of culture, and each one has an agreement a structure and a cell membrane, if you will. And so when you bring together people who are making meaning from a traditional, you know, a modernist and a postmodern into one social circumstance, then I think it's the duty of those who are postmodern and integral in a way to make modernists and traditionalists feel welcome in that space. Inevitably, there's some tension that goes with that, and it kind of depends on the goodwill of the people who were involved. Sometimes it can work, and sometimes it can't. When it comes to spirituality, it's important to see that culturally, too. In my latest book, The Presence of the Infinite, I spend a chapter talking about spiritual leadership. And when I describe spiritual leadership, I talk about it in terms of these the three major kinds of spirituality or, you know, orientation to ultimate reality, however you want to phrase it, that we see in the society. So we have religious spirituality, those who go to church or synagogue or mosque, or, you know, those who are involved in traditional religious practice. That's still about 40% of the United States. And there are many beautiful things about religious spirituality, despite its myths. There are also really important values and really important forms of culture that I think deserve our respect. And indeed, we can all learn a lot from religious spirituality of all kinds if we're open to it. Then there's, on the other side, what I phrase progressive spirituality, right? That's much bigger than what used to be called New Age. It includes all of the alternative forms to religious spirituality. While there are, you know, for example, Buddhism and Hinduism have been imported into the West, for most of the practitioners, the Western practitioners of those religions, they relate to it within a postmodern cultural frame. So while some try to be as traditional and they want to be true to that lineage, for most, within the cultural orbit of progressive spirituality, it's more eclectic and pluralistic. Indeed, this welcoming pluralism is one of the major achievements of progressive spirituality, is that there are all kinds of different spiritual paths are kind of accepted and more or less welcome within that culture. So if people are become drawn into the orbit of progressive spirituality, they're typically not just interested in Buddhism strictly or Hinduism strictly. They're interested in spirituality in general, and that means that they're interested in esoteric spirituality and nature-based spirituality and, you know, embodied practice spirituality, and everything's kind of, you know, there's a mixing and a blending. And while that can have immature expressions of cafeteria-style religion, there's also ways in which progressive spirituality is very liberating, right? Because it's not so much focused on belonging to a belief system as it is, you know, personal spiritual practice and growth. So progressive spirituality is a beautiful thing, but like religious spirituality, has its own shortcomings and limitations. And in between those two, in between, you know, progressive spirituality, which has a kind of a postmodern center of gravity, and religious spirituality, which has a kind of traditional center of gravity, we see it's fashionable in America. There's a kind of a secular approach to ultimate reality, which in the book I talk about in terms of secular spirituality. Maybe a better term would be a-spirituality. But the reason I think it's best to understand it as a form of spirituality, there's the new atheists and naturalists, scientific materialists, humanists, all of those who are committed to the belief that there's nothing supernatural or that there's no larger purpose to the universe. Secular spirituality is growing. It's probably 15% of the American population who identify with some form of atheism or materialism. And even though these people wouldn't agree that their point of view is a spirituality, it stands in for spirituality by claiming to be an explanation for what's really true and what's real. And because it's in competition with both religious spirituality and progressive spirituality, this secular, non-spiritual view is a kind of spirituality. I mean, there's no getting away from belief systems, right? You can't get away with not having one. You could try to make your belief system as minimal as possible, but the idea that you're eliminating spirituality by claiming that the universe is merely material, that's just the what Whitehead called the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, right? So when you're in a group, when you're in a community, and you have secularists, it's important to understand that, like most people in religious spirituality, this ethic of pluralism, where you accept that people who don't have the same spiritual view as you aren't necessarily wrong or deluded. So if you're a pluralist and you recognize that people who are engaged in a form of religious spirituality, even though they want to be exclusive, they can still be welcome. People who are engaged in a secular view, even though they want to be exclusive and claim, you know, that their way, that, you know, that any other spiritual explanation of the universe is wrong. There's a way to be loving and inclusive and tolerant and accepting of those views, you know, within this pluralistic environment that progressive spirituality has achieved. However, I'll say one more thing about that, and that is evolutionary spirituality, or integral spirituality, tries to push off against the limitations of progressive spirituality and re-include science on its own terms and come to respect the achievements of religious spirituality on their terms in a way that can actually synthesize the important truths that are being advanced by religious spirituality, secular spirituality, and progressive spirituality, while, you know, including all three but transcending all three at the same time. I can point people to my book, The Presence of the Infinite, if they're interested in that thinking. They can read more there.
Steve, I wanted to ask you one more question. When you were recently being interviewed on To the Best of Our Knowledge, you said this thing that really stuck with me. You talked about optimism as a responsibility.
Right, a moral duty.
As a moral duty. Can you talk about why you're optimistic right now?
Well, I'm optimistic because I see this as a very fecund time for evolution. You know, it's almost a cliche to talk about, you know, the Chinese character for crisis is the same character for opportunity, right? But that's where we are now, especially, you know, for example, the Republican Party, even by many of the responsible intellectuals who identify as Republican, are admitting, you know, that the right side of American politics is in a crisis with the emergence of the demagogue. But there's a tremendous opportunity for the right to evolve into a form of right-wing politics that is that incorporates many of the strengths of the left and can bring the important values of heritage and liberty at a new octave that can be more acceptable to people on the left, less threatening. They can really a new reborn, reformed version of the right, whether that means a third party, a new party, or, you know, something that arises from the ashes of the collapsed Republican Party after the election. I think that could bring with it a new spirit of cooperation through which you know, polarization could be overcome. There was a time, the post-war period from the end of World War II until about 1968, political scientists refer to this as the liberal consensus. You know, and during this time, even though they were still, you know, left-right, battling, it was a period wherein there was exemplary forms of bipartisan cooperation, and many legislative achievements were made during this period. And part of what allowed for that degree of cooperation was a sort of underlying ideology of patriotism, whereby people were kind of sort of justified in compromising for the greater good of the country. With the rise of postmodernism, that sort of complicated the question, because many postmodernists are seeking to transcend nationalism altogether and embrace a more world-centric morality. Right, so having compassion for the world, getting beyond the idea of Americans being somehow more morally valuable than other people, that's an important move. But it's also served to disrupt the agreement structure that made bipartisan cooperation possible in the past. So I'm optimistic because the way evolution works, the way it works at, across all the levels, is first there's differentiation. And that allows for a higher level of integration. So we're moving apart as a society. You know, postmodernism and traditionalism are kind of in this kind of intense culture war for the struggle for the moral soul of modernity. And recently, the power of traditionalism has been set back. You know, it's diminishing as a cultural force, I think, for, you know, positive reasons. Postmodernism is still in this kind of antithetical position, still, you know, rejecting much of what's come before. And so this is a kind of chaotic time where the value agreements that are necessary for a democracy to function, that those are in disarray. But that very situation is a perfect opportunity wherein, in other words, problems create the opportunity for evolution. And we now have this new problem of a stuck and dysfunctional democracy, and this problem itself is in a sense giving rise to an ability to recognize the higher values of this integral perspective, this post-postmodern worldview that can better include and synthesize these disparate values. So just as it seems like, you know, the differentiation is causing us to fall apart, the light of this integrative possibility, you know, this next stage of integration is now emerging. So in some ways, you know, our evolution is going according to schedule. You know, that is the forces, there's in every culture there are forces of decay and forces of growth. And if you focus exclusively on the trajectory of the forces of decay, it looks like we're, you know, collapsing as a civilization. And if you look only at the forces of growth without recognizing how these problems are the source of the energy for our further evolution, then you can become Pollyanna or unrealistic or not understand how the reason to be optimistic is because you have a new power to engage with the problems. So I'm not optimistic in the sense that I think everything's going to be fine without our effort, or that we're not in for a struggle ahead, or that, you know, that this is a difficult time of emergence and challenge. But what I am optimistic about is that what we've achieved historically, civilizationally, is strong enough, I think, to serve as a platform for our further evolution. And this integral worldview shows us what's next, and therefore gives us reason for optimism and indeed hope. And I think that the morale and the sense of possibility that really are part and parcel of optimism, you know, that's necessary to be able to participate in helping bring about this integral perspective, this next stage of culture. You know, I mean, I guess I'm optimistic because the integral worldview is now emerging, and you and I are participating in that emergence in this very conversation, and that from an integral perspective, the next phase of history, the second enlightenment, is dawning. And, you know, I think that while we're going to be living in a world of trouble and suffering throughout the rest of our lives, now that we're beginning to understand how culture evolves and how values have a gravity and how we can make things more beautiful, true, and good in real life terms, you know, I think, you know, beyond optimism, I, you know, really have a sense of joy.
Steve, thank you so much. This, of course, is just the tip of the iceberg for all the things that are going on. So if people want to find you and get in touch with you or learn more about all these things we've been talking about, where will they find you?
Well, the two main areas where I see this integral perspective can help solve problems or where its application could be most effective is in the realm of spirituality and politics. And so my work is kind of divided between those two focuses, although there's certainly overlap, you know, and synergies between the two. There's also ways in which these are distinct tracks. And so on the spirituality side, the main activities is this the writing of books, you know, and the giving of presentations that are associated with those books. And that can be found at my author website, which is stevemackintosh.com. And McIntosh is spelled with an M-C. So stevemackintosh.com, there are... there's an extensive book talk with a very lively Boulder audience, both for my 2015 book, The Presence of the Infinite. People can watch that video. And then I have another one for my 2012 book, Evolution's Purpose. And so those are free, you know, videos. There's also book excerpts. And going to the website, there's enough free content to kind of constitute a workshop on this integral perspective. So I invite people to go there. On the politics side, focus has been through this 501c3 nonprofit think tank that I've co-founded with Carter Phipps and others. And the headquarters for that work of the Institute for Cultural Evolution is culturalevolution.org. And not only are there kind of white papers and videos, there's also, you know, kind of tests, kind of a gimmick. You can take a test on the polarization to kind of see where you are within polarization. The idea there that one of the important projects of the Institute for Cultural Evolution is to help depolarize the American mind, as we frame it. So the polarization test is a 2-minute test you can take and has some exercises associated with that. And we recently added another questionnaire, online questionnaire, that's the it's a worldviews test. And although any kind of multiple choice test is inevitably leading, you know, it's sort of, you know, anybody can kind of figure out what the integral answer is, taking the test still helps you consider different worldviews and different values. And that's a fun activity, which will then diagnose the worldview that you identify with most and the one that you identify with least. And that's an activity that people can do on that website. But the juice of our perspective, this integral perspective, is really found in the papers. The latest paper that I published on the ICE website is Overcoming Polarization by Evolving Both Right and Left, and that's kind of an extensive white paper. And I'm about to publish another paper called Why Centrism is a Failed Strategy and How We Can Better Achieve Political Cooperation. That's another application of integral politics. And so I can point to the culturalevolution.org as the headquarters for my work and my colleagues' work on trying to advance an integral politics.
Perfect. And we'll put links to all those things there on the fractalfriends.us website. Steve, thank you so much. This has been amazing to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Duncan. I hope we can do it again. And I hope when you're either here out in Boulder, where I live, or I'm in the Bay Area, where you live, we can get together and further this conversation when we're together live.
Yeah, I would love that. Great. Well, Steve, thank you so much again.
Thank you for Fractal Friends and for your good work, and best wishes for it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to Fractal Friends today. I'm not going to be closing us out with a song today because I don't have one. If you are out there and you do have songs that you think should be played here on the Fractal Friends podcast, please reach out to me. My email address is duncan@fractalfriends.us. I also just want to reaffirm that if this episode stirred something up for you and you feel like you have a response you want to share, come on down to fractalfriends.us and leave some comments in the blog. That would be really appreciated, and it would be interesting to hear what people have to say. In the meantime, I'll just say thank you very much for listening, and have a nice day.